This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Why Not Me? This is the author, Mindy Kaling. Hello again. In seventh grade, I started at a new school. On the first day, I was so anxious to make friends, I brought a family-sized bag of Skittles to homeroom so I could pass them out and entice my new classmates to talk to me. "Do you like Skittles?" I asked. Kids would nod cautiously. "Here, take some. I'm Mindy," I said, trying to rope them into conversation. It didn't work very well. Even back then, the kids thought this was suspicious behavior, like I was covering for something unseemly that they couldn't quite pinpoint. Still, I persisted, striking up conversations like a middle school Hare Krishna and cornering kids with aggressively banal chit-chat. "That's so funny you like the color blue. I like turquoise. We're so similar." I did this until my art teacher, Mr. Posner, pulled me aside. Mr. Posner was soft-spoken and wouldn't let us talk about the movie Silence of the Lambs because it contained violence against women. I hated him. "You don't have to give people candy to make them like you, Mindy," he said. "They will like you. For you." I nodded meaningfully, knowing he wanted to see that my mind had been blown away by his awesome humanity. Then he took my Skittles, and I thought, what a load of garbage. At 12 years old, I had experienced enough to have zero faith in the power of my looks or personality to reel in friends I wanted so badly. I needed my Skittles. The next day I brought in more, and Mr. Posner called my parents. The Skittles stopped, and I wished that Mr. Posner was trapped in the bottom of a well and later killed, like in Silence of the Lambs. My parents encouraged me to play field hockey, where I eventually did end up making a few friends. I remember that time as one of the most stressful periods of my life. Every kid wants approval, but my desire to be well-liked was central to my personality. As I got older, I got craftier and less obvious, but I've always put a lot of energy and effort into people liking me. That's why I've never understood the compliment effortless. People love to say, "She just walked into the party, charming people with her effortless beauty." Well, I don't understand that at all. What's so wrong with effort anyway? It means you care. What about the girl who walked into the party, her determination to please apparent on her eager face? Sure, she might seem a little crazy, and yes, maybe everything she says sounds like conversation starters she found on a website, but at least she's trying. Let's give her a shot. And these days, I find I'm caring less and less about what people think of me. Maybe it's my age. Maybe it's my security and my career. Maybe it's because I'm skiller of flesh and the dolla dolla billy y'all, but if I had to identify my overall feeling these days, it's much more, screw it, here's how I really feel. The truth is, it's hard to get people to like you, but it's even harder to keep people liking you. You'd have to bring in Skittles every single day. The result of my not caring so much about what I say allows me to care more about how I say it. I think it makes my writing more personal and more enjoyable. If you're listening to this, you're probably a woman. Or perhaps you're a gay man getting a present for your even gayer friend. Maybe you accidentally bought this thinking it was the Malala book. However this book made its way from the female humor / brave minority voices / stress-free summer reads section of your bookstore to your hands, it doesn't matter. The important thing is you're listening to me now. Welcome. I'm excited to share my stories with you so you can hear what I'm really like. If my childhood, teens, and 20s were about wanting people to like me, now I want people to know me. So, this is a start. Enjoy. Mindy Kaling, Los Angeles, California. For the ladies. How to Look Spectacular, A Starlet's Confessions. At some point in the past few years, I transformed from Mindy Kaling, boring, anonymous comedy writer who buys her bras at TJ Maxx, to Mindy Kaling, red carpet glamour puss with perfect skin and shiny hair, outfitted in the latest fashion garments. This second person is the creation of a handful of talented people whose job it is to make me look good. I'm of course talking about the hair, makeup, costume, lighting, spackling, and hoisting departments. They all work hard, so all I have to do is show up in my sweatpants and zit cream and say the magic words, "Make me look gorgeous or you're fired." I'm just kidding. I don't do that. In fact, I don't have to do anything. That's why I'm a starlet. I mean, extremely grateful. If you're curious what I look like before all these people have worked their magic on me, just imagine Gollum from Lord of the Rings. Now, usually, people privy to this kind of valuable information keep it to themselves, because an unspoken rule among actresses is never tell any other woman the secrets of your beauty, even if she's a 95-year-old background actor playing a cadaver. Today she's a cadaver, tomorrow she's a cadaver on a CBS drama trying to balance a love life in her demanding job as a district attorney, you think suspiciously. That's why when actresses are asked in interviews about their obvious, face-altering plastic surgery, they say things like, "Oh, I would never get any work done." Then how do I look like this? "Oh, it's just a lot of rest, meditation, staying hydrated." One of the great things about women's magazines is that they accept that drinking water and sitting quietly will make your breasts huge and lips plump up the size of 2 bratwursts. Maybe it's because I'm such a rule breaker, maybe it's because I'm so down to earth, or maybe it's because you spent money on this book and I don't want you to return it, but I've decided to share my beauty secrets with you. Now you too can go from looking like Gollum in Lord of the Rings to a sexy, authentic Hollywood lady. Just listen to all the secrets I've learned and incorporate them into your own routine. It's easy, my precious. Get your hair on fleek. Is that word still cool? Was it ever? The first thing you need to know is that the hair on your head is worthless. The color, the length, the thickness, everything. You will never see anyone on TV sporting their own God-given hair, unless it's on, like, a sad miniseries about factory workers in East Germany. The same goes for hair color. Yes, your natural color may be appropriate for your skin tone, but this isn't the land of appropriate. This is Hollywood, baby. Out here, a dark-skinned woman's traditional hair color is honey blonde. A hip white woman's natural hair color is gray lavender. The real trick to having gorgeous hair is quantity. Piles of thick, cascading, My Little Pony-style hair signifies youth. So if you don't have that, you are basically announcing that you are old and dying. To keep up with this trend, everyone uses hair extensions. And I mean everyone. The stenographer who doesn't speak in the judge show you watch. The Long Island medium. Clooney. Castle. Everybody on the Today Show, but no one in the Orange Room. The entire family getting a new house on Extreme Home Makeover, including the kids. Charlie Rose. The obese woman on My 600-Pound Life. There are fable stories of what exactly is on Jeremy Piven's head. I am not throwing shade. I would look like the Crypt Keeper if you saw me with my natural hair on TV. It's a volume game, and he or she with the most hair wins. This is how you know you have enough hair. The weight of it gives you a splitting headache. At the end of the day, you find stuff in it, like receipts and wet Tic Tacs. If you are topless, your long and thick hair easily covers both of your breasts, which is great if you have to run to CVS and all your tops are in the wash. Hair is always getting caught in your armpits. You can pull guests up to the window of your second-story apartment with your hair, Rapunzel style. You're probably wondering where all this hair is coming from. Remember in middle school history class when you learned about the Dutch East India Company? They would travel all over Asia and India for spices to ship on the spice route to the New World. That mercantile route is essentially the same geographical route hair travels to get to actresses in Los Angeles. Locks of hair are culled from women in Asia and India. But instead of from the Dutch East India Company, you get them from places in downtown Los Angeles, with names like Diva Styles Human Hair by Giovanna. If you think about where your hair came from for too long, it can be very sad. So I prefer to tell myself vague lies, like maybe they're all deeply spiritual women, and cutting their hair off is part of some beautiful religious ritual. So they were going to do it anyway, and now they're just getting paid for it. Which is better than the reality that these women are all Fantine and we are monsters stealing their hair. You're probably wondering what you should do with the hair once you have it. I wear colorful, complicated clothes, so I keep my hair and makeup very simple. If I wear a neon yellow coat over a checkerboard dress and also have heavy eyeshadow and Orphan Annie curls, I will look like your aunt who just came out during Pride Weekend. I have to pick my appearance battles. If you're Natalie Dormer, you can take big fashion risks and shave half your head and it still looks good. If you're a normal person and you try that, it just looks like you had recent brain surgery. Spray tans. Surprise! I've been white all along. 2 or 3 times a year, I get a spray tan. But why, you ask? You already have dark skin. Like, really dark skin. Well, first of all, that's a little racially weird that you said that. Second, it's not about changing the color. It's about evening out the color. When I wear a strapless dress or act in a nude scene, I have noticeable tan lines just like white people. And unless I've been hired to do an American Apparel thong campaign, which, by the way, I'm totally into doing, tan lines are just no bueno for me. So the night before we are shooting a scene where I have to show a lot of skin, which happens way more than I ever thought, I get a spray tan. Basically what that means is a really brave woman named Jen will show up at my house with a machine that looks like a small stainless steel box to store a gremlin. And I will strip naked and stand in my bathroom with my arms and legs wide open and a guilty expression on my face. You don't have to wear underwear, but I always wear mine because it's important for Jen to know that I'm classy. When sweet, patient Jen has finished spraying a temporary dye all over my body with a little airbrush, she uses a blow dryer to dry me off. I'm so mortified during this entire process that I find relief in relentless chatter. Oh, I've heard American Horror Story is groundbreaking. Tell me about that. Like every scene from every episode. I get really focused on what we are chatting about, so in my mind, it seems like our conversation is the reason she is there. Not because she needed to paint my boobs with a dye called Chocolate Mama. But it's all worth it, because the next day I am a scrumptious golden brown delight, like a McDonald's hash brown. Oh, this old, perfectly tailored thing? I've always loved clothes. Like any normal woman, I would see a dress, buy it, rip the tags off with my teeth, save the buttons for 10 to 12 years in a drawer, and wear it to work. If I was going on a date, I might take a little extra care and use nail clippers to remove the tag, wear a cardigan on top, and cinch the whole look together with a wide belt. Cinch together the whole look with a wide belt was a very popular style in the early 2000s, which we believed accentuated our curves, but in reality made a generation of women look like we were wearing lumbar support braces. When I first met my costume designer, Salvador Perez, he was shooting the Lindsay Lohan starring TV movie Liz and Dick, which, from all accounts, was far more tumultuous than any actual interaction Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton ever had. The experience was hard on Sal, but excellent for me. Sal was so traumatized that he was extra willing to work on a show whose lead actress was only a little bit psychotic. Sal is a genius, and he has taught me that fit is everything. Whether it's Gucci or The Gap, he has everything tailored perfectly to my body, and it makes sense if you think about it. Why should the tunic that looks perfect on the live Amazon with a 3-foot-long torso modeling it in the J.Crew catalog look like a bathrobe on me? Oh, because that's what you think I look like? Never mind, skip this chapter. People sometimes sweetly say I have, quote, childbearing hips. But what they really mean is that I have hips that will definitely knock over your drink if you are sitting next to me on a plane and I have to get up to use the bathroom. I am somewhat happy with my legs. But I often find that when I buy a size up on a skirt to fit over my hips, the skirt becomes a little too long and I look like a religious woman. Which I would love, by the way. The doting Jewish husband, the house in Hancock Park, the wigs. After Sal got me into tailoring, I took all my skirts to get shortened to a much more flattering length. So at least my legs look good when my hips knock your sprite into your lap. What this means is introducing a tailor into your life. I know what you're thinking. Oh God, not another person I have to interact with. But trust me, this one will be worth it. Your tailor will transform all of your clothes to make them seem new again. Your tailor is the one person who will always make you look better after you see them. Soon, you will want to bring them on vacation with you. The best part is you are now one of those people who has a tailor, which makes you seem really old-fashioned and menacing, like Al Capone. The key to maximizing this perception is making sure that you make lots of angry, intense phone calls while your clothes are being measured. When I want to save money, I don't waste my time getting clothes that don't fit from Bloomingdale's. I buy things from a vintage store or an affordable chain and have them tailored to my body type. I wore a tailored dress from Old Navy to a wedding last summer, and it was a hit. It couldn't have been my personality. I was drunk as hell that night. Robots that enhance your looks. Ask any Hollywood makeup artist and they will tell you that they would rather cover up a giant green shamrock tattoo that spans half your face, Mike Tyson style, than a whitehead in the center of your forehead. Coincidentally, I have both. The reason is that color is much easier to cover up than dimension. It's way easier to paint over a tattoo than to somehow disguise a protruding pimple. When we are filming my show, I do not have weeks to wait to get rid of my pimples. It doesn't help that we shoot in high definition, which means that when the camera is on me in a close-up, you can all but count the pores on my nose. By the way, what is our fixation on high definition anyway? Everything is HD this and HD that. What if I don't want to see things that clearly on my television? Leave something to my imagination, bros. I liked it much better before, when televisions weren't so crystal clear. Like when I was 4, watching gymnastics in the 1984 Olympics, and the only way that I knew that the red, white, and blue blur bouncing around on the mat was Mary Lou Retton was because the announcer said so. This is the new cause that I feel most strongly about in my life. So I have had to learn some drastic ways to get rid of my zits. Only one thing has ever worked, and I have come to depend on one device, a special wand the size and weight of a remote control that shoots hot blue light into my skin. I bought this wand, the Tria Acne Clearing Blue Light, from my dermatologist's office. At one point, I was spending so much time with the device that I started calling him Wall-E. He looks like a fancy sex toy from Japan. His job is to eliminate acne-causing bacteria deep beneath the skin's surface. And I have to hold him pressed against my face for 20 minutes every night. The little whirring sound he makes when I switch him on is comforting. And what does Wall-E feel like? Like a tiny, white-hot iron you are pressing against your already sensitive pimple. It's hellish. But it's very effective at squashing and destroying pimples, so you don't care. Also, I think I have a pretty high pain threshold. Because one time, after a very long day of shooting, I was using Wall-E while I was watching TV and fell asleep. When I woke up, I had a rectangular burn mark on the side of my chin, but no zits underneath. Your boobs must be on fleek. Okay, now I know it's not cool. I'm saying it as a joke. I have never had any breasts to speak of. In high school, I wore the same white cotton jockey 34A bra for 3 consecutive years. It wasn't that I didn't have other bras. It's just that I barely needed one anyway, and it was comfortable. I did this until one day in the locker room after field hockey practice, Annie Devereaux asked me in a worried, secretly bitchy tone, "Why do you only have one bra?" I lied and said I had several exquisite bras at home, but I read that underwire gives you breast cancer, so I never wore them. Annie was dubious, but the conversation had taken such a depressing turn that she let it go. Soon after, I made my mom take me to Victoria's Secret, and I saw what I was missing out on. I didn't have to wear my stretchy white bra that looked like it was for someone going through physical therapy. My bra could be fun, sexy, in an outrageous color like neon pink. And that wasn't all. They had thongs that had your astrological sign and little crystals over the pubis. Underwear didn't have to be utilitarian. It could be a topic of conversation that announced your whole deal. My mom was supportive of this because I think she knew there was little to no chance any boy would ever see them anyway, so hey, why not? I asked her why she never had underwear like this. She smiled and said kindly, "These aren't for serious people." I think she was right because I have been wearing crazy bras ever since. For events, I wear a moderately padded bra. I found that a well-fitting padded bra can transform me from a pear-shaped woman to an hourglass-shaped woman. Okay, maybe not an hourglass-shaped, but definitely, say, an egg-timer-shaped woman. For me, it's not about being busty. It's about evening out the proportions of my body. The reason I only wear them to events and not in my everyday life is that a padded bra can look a little excessive on me. One time I wore one to work when my regular bras were in the wash, and my friend and co-worker Ike Barinholtz stopped in his tracks. "I'm sorry, why are your boobs so big?" he asked in a legitimately concerned tone. This reaction was so much more offensive to me than if he had said, "Hubba hubba." I suppose my modest-sized breasts are a constant that the people I work with have come to depend on, so I will keep them that way. Learn to lurk in shadows. Who is the beauty icon that inspires you the most? Is it Sophia Loren? Audrey Hepburn? Halle Berry? Mine is Nosferatu, because that vampire taught me my number one and number two favorite beauty tricks of all time. Avoid the sun at all costs, and always try to appear shrouded in shadows. Lighting in television and film is the real key to always looking beautiful. It's also the biggest mystery to me. I hired my cinematographer, Marco Fagnoli, based on one thing and one thing alone. His impressive and serious-sounding Italian name. As luck would have it, he also turned out to be a very talented DP, which stands for Director of Photography. Marco can take a foot-long square of orange cellophane, the kind they use to wrap cookies at the bakery, and tape it to the front of a light, and somehow I go from looking like Ving Rhames to Frida Pinto. It's remarkable. In addition to his other feats, making the San Fernando Valley look like the West Village in Manhattan, I can always count on Marco to make me look luminous and adorable. Like that kid who is fishing from the moon in the DreamWorks logo. So my advice to you is, try to befriend a cinematographer and have him or her light you wherever you go. Scary masks. When I was 15, I would wake up, wash my face with the same bar of Lever 2000 I used on my body, wash my hair with an all-in-one shampoo, and be done with it. Back then, we all thought Lever 2000 was the best because the number 2000 seemed so impressive. Were there 1,999 formulas before they landed on this one? That sounds really well-researched. I'm in. Oh, how I miss this charmingly low-maintenance version of myself. Now when I wake up, if I haven't gotten enough sleep, it shows. You know how on The Walking Dead, when a human gets bitten by a zombie, there's that 15-minute window after they are infected when they are transforming into a zombie, and their insides liquefy and their eyes turn into milky goo? That's what I look like. But no one in America will ever know that, because on those bad sleep days, my makeup artist, Cindy Williams, applies a beauty mask to my face. I keep mine in the fridge. Because there's two things Mindy Kaling likes cold. Beer and beauty masks. I'm testing out a new persona. Is she cool? The mask can also make me look like Hannibal Lecter, but at least he is a human. After the potions from the mask seep into my skin, Cindy peels it off, and I look like a woman you might want to be friends with. At least acquaintances with. Or at least a woman Michonne wouldn't stab in the brain with her katana. Arms are not your friends. The most valuable thing I learned from Kim Kardashian is that your arm must never lie flat against your body. The second most valuable thing is how to do this sex move called the Armenian Strangler, but that's for another book. I remember hearing her say that when you put your hand on your hip, it makes your arm look thinner and draws attention to your waist. I tried it, and I loved it. So I started doing it whenever I got my picture taken. I guess I was doing it a lot, because a blogger decided to write about it. This blogger had been semi-regularly writing mean stuff about me. And this snarky post was called, quote, Mindy Kaling sure likes to pose with her hand on her hip, end quote. The post contained a bunch of photos of me from separate red carpet events with my hand on my hip. When I first saw it, I felt so bad and embarrassed. What does this observation mean about me? It must mean I'm vapid or like really lame or aspirational or something. Then I realized it meant absolutely nothing at all. This person was desperate for a new way to diss me, and when he, that's right, he, men can be catty minos too, couldn't find anything substantive, he chose this. Because he figured, well, people probably resent actresses anyway for getting to get dressed up and pose for photos, so readers will love to mock her for this. And then I thought, wow, this poor sad guy. I pictured all the time he must have spent scouring through photos of me to find the ones where my hand was on my hip. And when he spotted one, eureka, he thought, excitedly dragging the image to his desktop, while his wife was probably in another room, watching TV by herself, wondering when he was going to come out of the den. Why doesn't he ever have time for me, she thinks. Next time my boss asks me to get happy hour hurricanes with him, I want to say yes. This was a grown man, and this was his job. Which brings me to another thing I learned from Kim Kardashian. Haters are just more people paying attention to you. And guess what? I looked great in all those photos he compiled. There, I've spilled all my beauty secrets, and it feels really good. Like, benevolent even? Maybe I will count this as my charity thing for the year. If you found this helpful, then great. And I am more than a little bit surprised. If this all sounded ridiculous, and you are laughing at what an idiot I am, that too is great, because talking about looks isn't important. It's just supposed to be fun. Some thoughts on weddings. I have been largely silent about my attitude towards weddings. Anyone who knows me even slightly will recognize how unusual that is, since I am notorious for making impassioned speeches about things nobody cares about. Like, I think it's a federal crime parking meters won't accept pennies. Yeah, government, we know pennies suck, but you made them. You have to accept them. I'm getting distracted. People assume I must love weddings, and that is understandable since the character I play on my show, The Mindy Project, has all but picked the DJ for the fantasy wedding in her head. And as a kid, I actually really loved the idea of having a fancy Judeo-Christian wedding. I remember lying in bed at night when I was 11 and dreaming about walking down the aisle with Dana Carvey, my biggest crush. All his Saturday Night Live friends would be on one side of the aisle, and my fifth grade friends would be on the other. And somehow, my parents were fine with me being a child bride, because the church lady was so funny, and Dana Carvey seemed like a sweet and decent guy. Now that I think about it, if I had married Dana Carvey at 11, that probably would have been a pretty good life. But the truth is, I really, really don't like weddings. Here's what I do like: love stories, romance. In fact, most of my favorite books employ the marriage plot. What is the marriage plot, besides the most interesting-sounding movie Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant never made? This is how I'd explain it. You know how all those movie adaptations of Jane Austen books end with Kate Winslet or Keira Knightley standing outside a chapel in the English countryside in a wedding dress with the man of their dreams? That's the marriage plot. A man and a woman are very attracted to each other, but there still seem to be lots of reasons why they can't be together. Sometimes it's logistical. He goes off to war. Sometimes it's situational. She's engaged to someone else. Sometimes it's emotional. He calls her family tacky and she thinks he's a dickhead. Whatever it is, the audience knows in the back of their heads that these two dum-dums will eventually figure it out and get together. And, if we're lucky, there'll be a funny sex scene along the way. But that's why I usually love the marriage plot, because you see everything except the wedding. I find, when I want to take an unpopular opinion about a controversial subject, it's useful to be really organized. The rest of this essay will discuss the various mild injustices that I've experienced at the many weddings I have attended, and explain, hopefully compassionately, why I dislike them so much. There are so few non-religious rituals that we have with our best friends. We can marry our boyfriends, and we can baptize our children, but we can't do anything official with our best friends, except get matching tattoos of clovers, which no one actually does, because who would let a friend do that? So the only real ritual we have is asking each other to be maids of honor or bridesmaids. Asking your friend to be a bridesmaid is one of the modern paradoxes. No one actually wants to do it, but everyone would be offended if you didn't ask. And why doesn't anyone want to be a bridesmaid? Because what women who have never done it before don't realize is that when you are a bridesmaid, you are required to be a literal maid for the duration of the wedding. You are in charge of the practicalities and the logistics of the ceremony, and not the fun parts, such as providing emotional support, making music playlists, offering fashion advice, and gossiping about which people from college got fat. The only difference between you and an actual maid is that you aren't getting paid, and you are supposed to love every second of your job. You even have to wear a uniform, a dress in the same color as the other maids, so everyone at the party knows whom to ask when someone is looking for a fridge in which to put her breast milk. This is particularly outrageous because the groomsmen do absolutely nothing. And I mean nothing. Being asked to be a groomsman means you get to give an incredibly inappropriate 2-minute speech, and every woman there will still want to sleep with you. As a bridesmaid, on the morning of the wedding, you will be unfolding the rusty metal legs of a banquet table. And in the distance, you will see a useless groomsman playing frisbee with a dog. To rub salt in the wound, he might lightly ask, "Is there anything that I can do to help?" Knowing full well no self-respecting bridesmaid will task him with any job because he will do it too slowly. But at least being a bridesmaid is a social activity and can be emotionally rewarding. What is not emotionally rewarding is a honey fund. There are few things that I have more ideological problems with than the concept of the honey fund. Hear me out. I love the idea of giving my newly married friends a meaningful present, but I don't love being asked to be an investor in a crowdfunded honeymoon. Here's why. It's not especially emotionally rewarding to know that I paid for 3 of 5 nights of a yurt rental in Big Sur. It's so transactional. Sure, everyone knows all wedding registries are essentially transactional, but at least they are transactional about objects, not people and experiences. I know you say you have too much stuff in your apartment, and what you really want is a killer honeymoon in Thailand. But I feel like if you have every material good you want, you're probably doing well enough to plan a honeymoon that is within your means. Because a honeymoon is, after all, a sex vacation you're giving yourself after a massive party in your honor. This brings me to the most common misconception I think couples have about a wedding registry. A gift registry is not about the relationship between man and wife. That's what vows in a marriage are for. The registry is about the relationship between the wedding guest and the couple. It's about your loved ones being able to give you a souvenir of their affection in the form of a tangible house helpful gift. This is my long-winded way of telling you that you will take my Calphalon wire cooling rack and you will like it. So why do I participate in any of it? Why not RSVP, no thanks, and hide behind my very busy schedule? Well, A, sometimes I do, and B, when I don't, the simple fact is that the brides are usually my closest friends. With my friends, the sad truth is that our best friend days are behind us. In college, we used to be able to meet each other in the common area of our off-campus housing, excited about our evening ahead, which consisted of someone making an enormous tureen of pasta and drinking wine from a box while we took turns regaling each other with details of our terrible love lives. Playful arguments would become fits of uncontrollable laughter, and like magic, that experience would be crystallized into a private joke, and the private joke would get boiled down to a simple phrase, which became a souvenir of the entire experience. For years to come, the phrase alone could uncork hours of renewed laughter. And as everyone knows, the best kind of laughter is laughter born of a shared memory. In my late 20s, when I moved to Los Angeles and all my friends seemed to spread out around the country, I would tell myself, once I am on hiatus from the show, I will visit them and everything will be the same. But the hiatus would come and go, and a movie role or rewrite job would keep me in LA. Until I realized, this long expanse of free time to rekindle friendships is not real. We will never come home to each other again, and we will never again have each other's undivided attention. That version of our friendship is over forever. And when I remember this, and it usually happens in those awful, quiet evening hours on Sunday nights, after dinner but before bed, I just lie on my sofa and cry for half an hour. I slip into a melancholy that I know is somehow tied to my deep-seated fear about not being married and having kids myself, because at its heart, my annoyance or impatience with my friend's wedding stems from my own panic and abandonment issues. Why are you leaving me behind like this, friend? What am I supposed to do all by myself now that you're gone? It's traumatizing to think that a best friend could become just a friend. That's because there's virtually no difference between an acquaintance and a friend. But the gulf between a friend and a best friend is enormous and profound. And if I look at it that way, I think I can see the value of a wedding. If you're my best friend, and the only way I get to have dinner with you is by traveling thousands of miles, selecting a chicken or fish option, and wearing a dress in the same shade of lavender as six other girls, I will do that. I won't love it, but I love you. Mindy Kaling, sorority girl. Though I went to a very artsy private school in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I wasn't raised by parents with a liberal attitude towards alcohol. There was no whimsical sip of wine at Thanksgiving for us kids while we were still teenagers, like if we were in a Noah Baumbach movie. That was for the cool Jewish kids. This was the Clinton era, and my parents were already worried about the moral deterioration of the country. So I drank skim milk with dinner, and did so pretty much every night until I was a story editor at the office. Thus, I never learned moderation. When I arrived at Dartmouth College in 1997, my attitude towards alcohol was that it was a delicious and dangerous treat that, when obtained, needed to be ingested quickly in case someone tried to take it away. You know, the way a raccoon eats from a garbage can. People who hear I went to Dartmouth are often surprised by how much I liked it. I think it's because they correctly assume that Dartmouth is extremely white, fairly conservative, outdoorsy, and in the middle of nowhere. And while all these things are true, I still loved it. How is that possible, you ask? How could a nature-hating, sedentary, aspiring, can I still say this, fag-hag, feel so at home in rural New Hampshire? I'll tell you how. All that hunky blonde tail is how. Just kidding. I find blonde men creepy and unnatural. Just kidding. Every guy hated me. I love Dartmouth because the minute you set foot on campus, it's like you were in a watercolor painting from your dentist's office called New England College. Because it looks so much like the idealized film version of college, I always felt that cinematic college-y things were going to happen to me there. Also, most of my fellow students did not look like me or share my interests, which actually made me feel special. Dear old Dartmouth, whose motto is Vox Clamantis in Deserto, which translated from Latin means white men crawling out of the forest. In Hanover, New Hampshire, a chirpy Indian improv comedian who was constantly talking was something of a novelty to the scores of wordless men named Brian. And because Dartmouth was founded in 1769, it had lots of those quintessentially old East Coast college traditions like secret societies, ghost stories, catchy old fight songs that are later deemed racist, and most important, a Greek system. For a moment, let's pretend I was born a white man. Chris Christie, how dare you? Obviously, I would be John Lovitz. Now imagine the white male version of me as a freshman at Dartmouth in the late 90s. Kind of a sweet bozo, right? Awful cargo pants, boat shoes, inviting everyone back to the basement of his frat to drink and play pong. This sweet young Lovitz version of me would probably have died of alcohol poisoning before sophomore year, since frat guys had ready daily access to alcohol, and because at 18, I must admit, I loved to drink. At Dartmouth in 1997, you would walk into the basement of any fraternity, and there was a 100% chance that you would find a warm keg of Bud and a glassy-eyed young man with undiagnosed depression, eager to pour you some. I could not have handled that. Luckily, I was not born a white man. This statement has never been said before in the history of humanity. I was born a socially anxious Indian woman. And while I loved my college and my extracurricular activities, I didn't have access to any kind of parties, which is why I wanted to be in a sorority. Seeking friendships as seen on TV. I have a complicated relationship with the Greek system. One side of my personality is absolutely suited for sorority life. I'm an organized person who loves the structure of weekly meetings and scheduled socializing, and I even see the value in hierarchies. I think gentle hazing of the pledges must wear such and such outfits variety is charming and fun. And I am a firm believer that the best friendships come from mandatory time doing tedious chores. Like when a bad kid and a good kid have to spend Saturday cleaning the teacher's lounge, and they learn they're not so different after all. That said, I do think that perpetrators of some of the worst, most sexist, and most dangerous behavior at Dartmouth were from the Greek system. But I thought, those are fraternities, not sororities. I'll never make another woman chug her own urine while my friends chant, chug, chug, chug. Sure, it's hilarious and probably cements friendships for a lifetime. Not to mention I once half read an article about Madonna drinking her pee for health reasons, but it's wrong. So I thought, maybe I'll join a sorority. At Dartmouth, there are many sororities, each with its own reputation. To paint a picture of my options at the time, I will describe some of them now. Please know that these are all subjective, probably offensive, doubtlessly incorrect sentiments based on attending Dartmouth College in a pre-9/11 era. Now that my disclaimer is done, I can make fun of some sororities. Kappa Kappa Gamma, svelte blonde or East Asian women, frequently seen running a 7-minute mile on the treadmills at the Zimmerman Fitness Center, mouthing words to Dixie Chick songs. Who would I cast in a movie about them? Rosamund Pike. Delta Delta Delta, never not smiling, never not baking cookies. Their finely toned arms replace a finely honed sense of irony. Who would I cast in a movie about them? Carrie Underwood. Kappa Delta Epsilon. Brunette Kappa, most rumored access to cocaine. Highest proportion of tramp stamps. Sexy party girls who could do cool things like rip a condom open with their teeth. Who I would cast in a movie about them? Mila Kunis. And finally, Sigma Delt. Brassy girls, athletes, drinkers who could, quote, party like the guys. Girls who own dogs. Feminist and lesbian friendly. Who I would cast in a movie about them? The background actresses of Orange is the New Black. Sigma Delt didn't expressly advertise to be the place where minority women interested in the performing arts would thrive. But you know how all the guys who were into theater tech from your high school were also into Monty Python? Something about these rowdy, rugby-playing lesbians seemed like they would be into my little sketch comedy plays. I learned about Sigma Delt because I was a member of a student group called Hanover Crew. Hanover Crew was a group of sophomores, juniors, and seniors selected to welcome incoming freshmen through songs and sketches before they departed for a week-long outdoor adventure. I applied because it was very exclusive, and I longed for the power trip and free t-shirt that came with it. This school-wide freshman tradition, imaginatively called trips, was one of the best experiences that I ever had at Dartmouth. Groups of nervous 18-year-olds arrived for their freshman year and were greeted by Hanover crew. They were then clumped with other freshmen they didn't know to kayak, canoe, hike, and horseback ride through the beautiful White Mountains for a week. And then they all regrouped at the top of Musalak Mountain for a night of delicious food, a student-ridden musical performance, and ghost stories. Trips lasted 3 weeks, during which Hanover crew lived, ate, and slept in the same place. So the 14 of us grew very close. There were 7 guys and 7 girls. I was the only sophomore girl and was taken under the wing of 2 impressive junior girls named Risa and Jeanette. Risa and Jeanette were also in Sigma Delt. Risa was captain of the crew team and the first openly gay woman I had ever met. She looked like Jennifer Garner, had a voice lower than any woman or man on Hanover crew, and even now, I have never seen a woman with a body as good as hers. Jeanette was a tiny, stylish, potty-mouthed party girl who wore a blue clip-in extension in her jet-black hair. She taught me how to fill in my eyebrows with an eyebrow pencil. Her catchphrase for whenever anyone was excited or into anything was, "Oh my God, they're going to cum their pants." To this day, I use this disgusting phrase at least once daily because I think it must be as incredibly charming as I thought it was in 1998. I had never met 2 cooler, more self-actualized, strong women. I followed them around, smitten, and in return, Risa and Jeanette adored me. They thought I was funny and subversive, because I did things like greet freshmen by saying, "Welcome to Dartmouth. I am the ghost of a kid who died on her freshman outdoor trip." I should remind you that there are only like 12 funny people in the state of New Hampshire at any given time, so this was actually pretty impressive. By the end of Hanover crew, after spending all of my time with Risa and Jeanette, I became infatuated with the idea of being in their sorority. I mean, I could hang out with the 2 coolest upperclassmen I knew and be invited to all their cool activities. They were planning a spaghetti dinner where everyone could watch the Nagano Olympics on their giant flat-screen TV. I remember this detail very clearly. The fact that I had no place to watch the Olympics was stressing me out for some reason. Pledge season started, and with Jeanette and Risa's recommendations, I was offered a bid. That moment, I will remember forever. The feeling of being offered entry into something old and exclusive was like a drug rush to my young, elitist brain. I accepted, proud of my achievement, ignored the fact that I had done virtually nothing to earn it, and started the pledge process. Please like me. I'm going to gently assume that if you're listening to this book, you are a little bit of a nerd. Or perhaps you're a man whose nerd girlfriend is taking a long time in the bathroom and you can't figure out how to turn on her television. So I need to give you a quick primer on sorority language. Rush is the mutual selection period where 2 things happen. 1, prospective fraternity and sorority members investigate houses, and 2, the sororities and frats evaluate the would-be members to see if they'd be a good fit. AKA, if they are hot enough to attract members of the opposite sex to their house for parties. After a few weeks of strange little tea parties and chill barbecues, the frats and sororities ostensibly know enough to offer bids. Ah, bid day. The day on Dartmouth campus, you could see girls either shrieking with happiness in food court, or, for the unlucky ones, weeping on the phones to their moms, wondering if they should transfer to Duke. Once the bids are accepted, the prospective members become pledges, and the pledge period begins, lasting for several months until initiation night. Initiation night is usually the most important night of the year for the Greek system, and where most traditions are shared with the youngsters. It can be emotional and moving, or mired in vomit and blood. Sometimes both. Pledges populated the Dartmouth campus scenery, like pine trees, red solo cups, and built-in bra tank tops. They were always in some amusing state of mandatory fraternity garb. You could tell a pledge was a chi-gam because they all wore signs with their names around their necks. Alpha Chi made their pledges grow out facial hair or wear the same plaid shirt for 4 weeks. Because Dartmouth is in the middle of nowhere, I think giving people secret rituals was also a way of entertaining everyone on campus. I'm the kind of person who encourages her employees to dress up for every holiday, even bank holidays, in a literal-minded way. For example, green and brown for Arbor Day, leaf earrings. So I found this gentle sartorial hazing very charming. As a pledge, I was game for all of this. What would Sigma Delt dream up? Pigtails and face paint? Color-coordinated kilts? All any girl wants to do in college is dress like a hot slut and be able to say that it was mandatory. But they didn't do any of that. All the Sisters of Sigma Delt required was for us to show up at events with other pledges and drink. I met the other pledges. There is Jenna, the younger cousin of the icy and extremely thin Sigma Delt recruitment chair, Caitlin. This is not her real name. Caitlin looks like the actress Angie Harmon, crossed with a Mexican Day of the Dead skeleton. The cheekbones on Caitlin's stone face could open a bottle of stone face. Her gorgeous slash alarming appearance was perfect for a powerful senior, because whenever she entered a room, your inclination was to stare at her anyway. We all thought her younger cousin Jenna was cool and connected. She was in the same extended family as Caitlin. She was there, ostensibly, when the cheekbones first emerged. We were impressed. The only other girl I remember was a small blonde named Maddie, whose main distinguishing trait was that she had been a child actor in Home Alone 2, which was something we actually thought was pretty cool. I'm sorry, do you have any Macaulay Culkin stories? I don't. We spend a lot of time together. One afternoon, a group of us hiked down to the Connecticut River to cheer on a junior named Abby, who had a crew race against Columbia. I didn't know Abby, but I went along, face-painted with a big green go on my forehead and Abby across my cheeks. While we waited, we chatted, and I felt my heart race with the hope and excitement of a good conversation. Did they like comedy? Did they have funny opinions about stuff? Jenna steered the conversation with stories of her and Caitlin's family's jointly owned vacation property in the Berkshires. I actually like hearing about rich people's vacation homes, but only if they're filled with scandalous stories, like the Kennedy compound. As Jenna talked about her amazing cousins and the splendor and tranquility of her family's second home, we watched two boats glide by in the distance. Abby was on one of them. If you've never watched a crew race, this is how it goes down. Once the boats appear, you scream loudly for 9 seconds until they disappear out of view. Then you wait 40 minutes for someone to bike over to the finish line and tell you the outcome. It's a little anticlimactic. That night when I got home, I had a slightly uneasy feeling. I had hugged all the other pledges when we left, and we declared it a, quote, super fun afternoon. But was it really? It secretly felt more like when someone gives you a holiday card that says, "A donation has been made in your honor to such and such charity," and all you really wanted was one of those enormous tins of tri-flavored popcorn. The wonderful thing about being at Sigma Delt was that I was the only person even approximating funny, and therefore I was deemed insanely hilarious. It's a nice feeling when, during a particularly uneventful house meeting, you mime slitting your wrists out of boredom, and people around you think you're the next Jim Carrey. Being funny made me well-liked, but it also made me the sorority jester. After a night of drinking beer and playing Pong, we would go to the basement library, where I was encouraged to do impromptu comedy routines in the center of a circle of sisters. They loved when I would do impressions of guys who Sigma Delt sisters had slept with, so that was an area I drew from. "Do Andy Trevello," someone would shout, and I would do my best impression of lacrosse player Andy Trevello, whose defining characteristics were that he was not very smart, and rumor had it that he could suck his own penis. You know, just that really highbrow, intelligent comedy that you've come to expect from me. "She is so funny, you will cum your pants," Jeanette said of me on her first pledge night. Now I started to wonder sadly, if I'm so busy making people cum their pants, who's going to make me cum mine? I look forward to our initiation night, when at last I would break the chains of pledgedom and become a regular sister. We had heard rumors of initiation night from Jenna and how special and sacred it was. I was so excited, I remember calling my mom and saying earnestly, "I think this might be one of the most truly memorable nights of my life. I hope I never forget it." She laughed, told me I was over my meal plan by more than $1,000, and asked how many meals I was eating a day. I hung up, a little miffed. On initiation night, we arrived to an empty house full of lit candles. "Ooh, I love this," I thought. "This is so very The Skulls, a movie that stars Paul Walker and Joshua Jackson at the height of their hotness." We were then told to strip down to our bras and underwear, a little gay but nice. We're blindfolded, gay, made to drink mysterious libations, fruit punch laced with vodka, dip our hands into eerie concoctions, spaghetti and grapes, and then led downstairs, where the blindfolds were removed, and we were standing in the basement surrounded by all of our sisters and 20 pizzas. These were essentially the activities of a kid's Halloween party that a pedophile might throw. But these were the ancient Sigma Delta pledge rituals. It wasn't exactly the secret rituals of the Masons, but it was some enjoyable bonding on a junior varsity level. And what percentage of blindfolded activities end in pizza? The following week, I missed a Sigma Delta pumpkin carving party because I had a Latin exam I needed to study for. The next day, I received an email from Caitlin about it. We were just really bummed because we were so excited to see what funny thing you would carve into your pumpkin. It was sad thinking of hot Day of the Dead skeleton Caitlin waiting for me, hopefully, with a knife and a pumpkin. After I missed a Sigma Delta rugby game to go to my Dog Day players rehearsal, Risa sat me down at the Dirt Cowboy, a cool Seattle-style coffee shop in the middle of town where people went for serious talks. When she explained what the meeting was about, I was surprised and a little alarmed how closely my attendance was being monitored. I explained how important my improv troupe was to me, and Risa nodded, serious-faced, with the resolute empathy of someone who has no idea what you were talking about. She leaned in and took my hand. "We're just worried that you're withdrawing from the other sisters, and that maybe you're depressed." So much of college is girls labeling other girls terrible things when they don't like their behavior, but using concerned language so they have plausible deniability if they get accused of being bitches. That girl is not cheerfully doing what the rest of us are doing, so she is probably depressed, or has an eating disorder, or is weird with guys, and so on. I was slowly discovering that I had nothing in common with any of these girls, except that we were all excited to see the Nagano Olympics on a big TV. But even the majesty of the Olympics could not keep me loyal to this group for much longer. The last straw was one weekend when I was away at Middlebury College with my improv troupe, and Sigma Delta was throwing a party with Phi Cap, the fraternity across the street. I couldn't attend, but I wasn't upset because Phi Cap was mostly handsome closeted guys on the diving team, and a chubby Indian freshman girl into improv comedy was probably not a convincing beard. I mean, even your mom would probably know the jig was up. I mean, why not just come out at that point? So I gladly sat that one out and went to Vermont to do improv. The next afternoon, however, when I arrived back in Hanover, I found a letter that had been slid under the door of my dorm room. I was being fined $100 for not reporting to Sigma Delta at 8 a.m. to clean up after the party, which was a chore for the pledges. I was outraged. $100? To clean up after a party I hadn't even gone to? In my mind, when the good kid and the bad kid have to clean up together, it was for camaraderie building. They don't do it because they're going to get invoiced if they didn't. I wrote to Jeanette and Risa immediately and told them that Sigma Delta was not for me. "What? No! Boo!" wrote Risa. If Jeanette was hurt, she hid it in a very formal tone. Well, something this serious should not be done over email. You owe it to the sisterhood to meet in person for coffee to discuss this. You know how girls are always saying that guys broke up with them, and it wasn't the breakup itself. It was the way they did it that was so uncool. It was around the holidays. It was the week of her mother's birthday. It was on the telephone. And you are listening thinking, so the only decent way for him to have broken up with you is to not break up with you and stay with you forever? That is what Sigma Delta was doing to me. I finally understood how guys felt. So I met Jeanette and Risa at the Dirt Cowboy to break up the right way. Before I could say anything, Jeanette coldly asked if I was an only child. I said no. "I'm very surprised," she said. As an education major, she said I displayed qualities that an only child would have. Risa was less angry and was just sad. "It's just, you're so funny, the impressions, the song parodies. Who will make us come our pants?" There was a long silence during which I suspect I was expected to cry. I couldn't muster up tears, but I did do some low moaning, like this decision was causing me physical pain. "Oh, this sucks," I moaned. "It's so unfair," I said, as though the choice to leave was somehow being forced upon me. A trick boys would later employ on me to extricate themselves from dating me. Karma, I guess. Finally, though, I couldn't beat around the bush anymore and guiltily asked, "Can I please sign the paper to deactivate?" I signed it. They left. I finished my hot chocolate, and I never set foot in Sigma Delta again. I thought I would like an environment of all women, where I was deemed the, quote, funny one. But it took me 12 weeks to realize that I don't really like organizations where people are deemed things. I should mention that I did learn a few undeniably useful things at my sorority. Like, A, the trick to getting any guy to fall in love with you is to laugh at everything he says and touch your mouth a lot. And B, in a pinch, you can wash your bras in a salad spinner. The problem with joining a sorority was that I was a person who wanted to make friends based on common interests. And our common interests had to be more than simply wanting to make friends. As someone who enjoys secrets, exclusivity, and elitism, I basically live to one day meet someone who owns an American Express Black Card, I was surprised and sad when I realized I was never meant to be Greek. Ultimately, I got out of the Greek system unscathed. Later, I would read accounts of pledging at Dartmouth, where it seemed like everyone was given alcohol poisoning and then ordered to set fire to the music library in the nude or something. I did not have that experience, and I know many friends who love their sororities. I wasn't traumatized. I was just bored. Minor fame has changed me. When I was on The Office, I was the perfect kind of famous. A little bit famous. Double take at the airport famous. Occasionally, someone would come up to me and excitedly say, "That's what she said." And I would smile knowingly and respond, "Steve's great, isn't he?" Implying that Steve Carell and I are very close friends who vacation together. Now things are a little different. To clarify, I'm by no means famous-famous, like Rihanna or a Kardashian or Nicki Minaj's butt. Those are people who have to wear makeup when they exercise, which is a whole other tier of fame. Being known is really fun, extremely strange, and not very important. And this is what it's like. These are the things I can no longer do now that I'm famous. Bargain for stuff. Like every normal person, when I go to a flea market, I don't want to be the chump who pays the asking price for anything. But recently, my friend BJ pointed out that loudly bargaining in public is unbecoming for actresses with their own TV shows. His theory is that people think I'm filthy rich, and no one wants to see that either A, I'm not rich, and how alarming is that? Because what kind of drug problem could I have where I frittered away all my TV show money, and now I have to bargain at a flea market? Or B, I'm rich and cheap, which is universally regarded as the worst thing you can be. Say offensive things. Look, would I love to be able to freely spout the gently racist, sexist stuff that sometimes crosses my mind when I'm the worst version of myself? Sure, that's part of my candid first-generation immigrant charm. One Saturday afternoon several summers ago, I went to visit my friend Brenda in Provincetown, Massachusetts. Provincetown has a large gay population, and during the summer, there are even more gay tourists. Brenda and I were walking down their main street, and we were slowed down by throngs of gay tourists walking very slowly, taking in the sights and sounds. Frustrated, I wanted to say, "Man, this place is gay as hell," but I didn't. I didn't want people to go home and tell their friends that the girl from the Mindy Project found something, quote, too gay. I would never want a homophobic reputation, for many reasons, the most important being that I'm aspiring to be a tragic gay cult icon. Also, it is wrong. So I just let out a frustrated sound and said, "Crowd!" I actually think that this new self-awareness has made me a better person. Online dating. Sadly, I believe the legitimization of online dating coincided with my becoming a little bit famous. Even in the mid-2000s, my friends online dated, but acknowledged that they felt like slightly desperate creeps doing it. Now even my coolest friends are online dating, but not me. I live in fear of my public profile being published online for everyone to see, especially since I am such a liar. On a dating profile page, I would pretend to be a completely different person. You would see me loving live music and hiking. You basically leave the date thinking I'm an outdoorsy Stevie Nicks. Frown. About a year ago, I had lunch with Reese Witherspoon in Brentwood to discuss a project we were thinking of working on. I know that the beginning of the story is incredibly insufferable, but let me continue. When we were walking back to our cars, a couple of photographers were waiting to take her photo. She whispered to me, "Smile." "Why?" I asked. "We're just walking to our cars." Reese responded. No one who sees a photograph of us wants to see that we are anything other than totally happy all the time. At first I thought that couldn't possibly be true, but then in the drive home,